Hello, I'm John Kelly, and this is a podcast of Mystery Train. For rights reasons, the music is shorter than in the original programme. Mystery Train hits the rails Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on RTE Lyric FM. And that was Dream Song from Eric Friedlander. That's a piece of music I've been playing for years on the programme. It comes from an album called Block Ice and Propane. Really wonderful record from Eric. And I'm delighted to say that tonight, the Sunday night where we get someone in to pick the tracks, that Eric Friedlander, just in from New York, is going to pick all the music tonight. Eric, good to see you.
Good to see you, John.
It's been a while, and I've always wanted to get to talk to you in this context where we could really kind of relax and talk about music
right,
at length, because I know your influences are wide. And let's get into the story straight away, Eric. Were you born in New York?
I was born in New York City, and then my parents moved out of town to the suburbs. And I grew up out of New York City, about 35, 40 miles.
Now, what does it mean, you know, if you live 35 miles out of Dublin, you're in the country. You're not a Dubliner at all. If you live 35 miles out of New York, what does that signify?
Well, when my parents put down stakes, it was pretty countrified. It was like lots of acres of just forest, and so I definitely grew up in the sticks, as we say.
But did you feel yourself a New Yorker? No.
No, not till I moved there after college. Mm. Yeah, New York is a crazy place to visit. I didn't enjoy it so much when I was growing up, but when I live there, it's fantastic.
See, I'd have thought if you were a kid and you're living in 30 miles from New York and you can probably see New York from the nearest hilltop, it must have seemed like Oz or something, some really exciting place.
Yeah, we would cut school and drive to New York and see movies and drink beer.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I probably would have done the same. Did you cut school to go and see any of the music that was happening in New York?
Sure. I'd go see rock and roll concerts. I'd go see Queen and Thin Lizzy and The Who and Pink Floyd.
Wow.
That was one of my high school obsessions.
Yeah, that's an opportunity that we didn't have. Thin Lizzy, though, we did see a lot.
Yeah, they're an Irish band, aren't they?
Yeah, they're a great band. The Irish band.
Yeah.
Yeah, terrific. What age are you, Eric? Are we the same age?
I'm 58.
Oh, a little bit older than me. Just. Yeah. But yeah. Yeah, Thin Lizzy was an important band in my my teenage years. Yeah, absolutely it was. So you're living in, what was the name of the place?
New City.
New City.
Yeah.
New City.
New City.
And was
Sounds
it
a, biblical.
Was it a new place? Was it a
no,
invented?
I'm not a big fan.
Yeah. Okay, we're not talking about that. When did you move into, when did you move to New York to live? Was that?
78.
And where were you at that stage?
I was uptown at Columbia University.
Right.
Where I went to school. And I went to school for 4 years there and then just stayed.
And what were you studying there?
Music. Columbia is kind of the old style university or college experience. They have a core curriculum, so you have to read all the great works and the great philosophers and the Bible, and so you get kind of a good, well-rounded education, and that was enough for me. I had my 4 years. I had a great time, and I got out and started working as a musician.
Still, you would have learned a lot.
Yeah.
It sounds like a pretty good grinding.
Yeah, it was pretty good. It was pretty good. I made some great friends, and learned a lot.
Okay, your first musical choice, Eric, is an old R&B number from way back in the day. And we can probably discuss where you might have come across this particular musician in a little while. But tell me about Big Joe Turner.
Well, Joe Turner was part of the fabric of my childhood, because my father is a photographer. He was a real music fan and a kind of obsessional tape maker and mixtape maker, and part of he would play all sorts of music to go to the dark room and work in the dark room. He would play loud music downstairs in the dark room and in the living room, And a lot of what we heard of was R&B from the Atlantic from the 60s and the 50s, 60s. And so it was just my sister and I would sing this song that we're going to play, Lipstick, Powder, and Pain. And it was just a part of the fabric of my early years.
Okay, here we go. Joe Turner, Big Joe Turner. Lipstick, Powder, and Paint. Joe Turner there. They sure knew how to make records in those days. Eric,
yes.
Eric Friedlander
just
is with
a couple
me in
of
studio.
Mics.
Yeah, and we were just on, when you were walking into the studio, we were talking about Atlantic and how they would literally in the evening just move the office furniture.
Yeah.
and record these records, which were perfect for radio. They sounded
right.
Extraordinary on the radio.
Unbelievable.
Now, you mentioned that your dad was a photographer.
Yeah.
No ordinary photographer, though. Lee Friedlander is a very famous American photographer.
Yes. Yes, he's a... Well, he told me he never expected that artwork would do anything for him, his career. He expected to be just a working photographer doing magazines when magazines were hot back then. There was a lot of work in magazines, Sports Illustrated, Holiday, Life, Time, and all the magazines were hiring photographers. And... he also worked for Atlantic Records doing record covers because he was such a music fan that he knew all the artists and would hang out at clubs at night. And so he got to know the Erdogans, and they hired him to do record covers.
See, it's extraordinary, Eric, the first time I met you, and the name Friedlander. I'm sure there's loads of Friedlanders in America, but I always knew that name, Lee Friedlander, because, like a lot of kids, when you only have a few records, you read the sleeves very intently.
Like, obsessively. Yeah.
And his, you know, I knew the address of Atlantic Records and all kinds of stuff, but there was this name always, Lee Friedlander. There was his name. Those photographs of Ray Charles and Charles Mingus and John Coltrane.
Right.
And Miles and Big Joe Turner and all these people. What did that mean to you as a kid? Because sometimes when your dad does something and you're a kid, it just seems sort of normal. You know?
Yeah, it was hard to say because I have nothing to compare it to. It was just like what he did, and we were kind of, my sister and I were kind of, it was just like the furniture.
Yeah.
You know, it was just what he did, and we were... in my Block Ice and Propane show, I say we were along for the ride. We were kind of just, we were passengers on this trip that he was taking.
It was
taking
a great
pictures.
Trip for him, though, because he was a music fan.
He was a huge music fan, and he used to hang out at all the jazz clubs. And when he was a kid growing up in Aberdeen, Washington, he would hitchhike to the major cities around Seattle and go see music underage, you know, sneak in and see the music.
And did his world and your world when you were younger collide at all? I mean, I'm wondering, did you ever run into any of these Atlantic Record musicians yourself?
Well, no. That's an interesting question. He didn't involve me in any of his work. There was kind of a good side to it. I felt like I was a free agent to decide my future on my own. But I also think it would have been great for him to share his work in the sense of just like a man doing work.
Yeah.
And this is what it's about, and this is how I do it. But he was not that, he didn't involve us in any of that stuff. And so I wasn't part of the world.
And because of your age then, you wouldn't have been in those clubs.
Right.
Before you
would
have met these
guys.
Well,
I did go to a recording session with Rahsaan Roland Kirk.
Oh, wow.
And that was very impressive.
That's it, was.
Yeah.
No, it's funny, a few of the people we've had in here on Sunday nights, you know, they've had famous parents in one way or another, including Eric Mingus, who you probably know.
Mm.
Well, Eric, you know, I asked him, you know, well, what was it like when you're that age and you know Monk and Coltrane and Miles and all this kind of, as Eric did know these people.
Yeah.
And he said, well, these were just dudes who were hanging around my house.
Right.
You know?
Right, I know.
Which is kind of extraordinary, but, you know, if you're in the middle of it, it mightn't seem quite the same thing.
Right, I know. My sister and I, we would go to openings and photo openings, and my father taught at Rice University. Once he's not a very good teacher, And he doesn't like it very much. But we would be asked, what is it like to have a famous photographer as a father? And we just draw a blank. It was just... And you know, we would go on these long trips every summer. Every summer until I was 17, we would go on these long trips in the back of a camper. And my father would basically use these trips to string work together so he could photograph locations that he liked. So we would go to a workshop in Aspen and a week teaching job in San Francisco. And we would drive all these miles, spend 2.5 months on the road every summer.
As you say, along for the ride.
Yeah, and so we would he'd stop along the road to take pictures, and it would be 102 in the shade in Arizona, and we would just be sweltering up in the camper.
But what a picture.
Yes, exactly.
So Aretha Franklin is your next choice.
Yes.
Chain of Fools. Again, someone I assume your dad would have photographed.
Absolutely,
many times.
Some great pictures of Aretha, and she just passed, so it's this is a great one.
Okay, Chain of Fools.
Chain, chain, chain. Chain, chain.
And that's Aretha Franklin there in Chain of Fools. The choice of Eric Friedlander is with me in the studio tonight. Eric is a cellist, among many other things. And maybe you should talk a bit about that, Eric. I mean, you began, as you say, you were exposed to a lot of R&B. And you began, I guess, like a lot of kids, with a guitar.
Right. At age 5, I played the guitar. I learned folk guitar and tablature and finger picking. And then at age 8, in third grade, the local public school offered a cello or violin. And for some reason, I picked the cello. Maybe they picked it for me because I guess I was kind of a bigger kid and could maybe handle the cello. Mm. And they gave me a plywood cello and a pretty crappy bow. And I started playing.
Now, when you were playing guitar, you said you were playing folk. Was that with a view to... Was that because you were interested in folk music? Or, you particularly wanted to learn finger picking and all that kind of style? Because you're only 5.
I know, I'm only 5. It's hard to remember. I think it was just because it was the local community center who had a teacher, and that's what they taught.
Sure.
And it was easy for my parents, and they brought me by. And
I mean, had you been listening to, I don't know, Burl Ives or...
Yeah, we listened to Pete Seeger.
Pete Seeger, yeah.
Yeah, Burl Ives, the Mamas and the Papas, all that stuff.
A lot of that stuff does appeal to kids, and actually some of it's specifically for kids.
Oh, yeah,
as
Pete
well.
Seeger, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess I did get into it, and I learned James Taylor songs and Carly Simon and you know, so I was learning that stuff, but the cello came in at age 8.
And did the guitar just stop at that point?
Mostly.
Yeah.
So
what did you like about the cello? As you say, an 8-year-old probably hasn't heard, you know, cello concertos or one. Maybe you had, but I'm just wondering what was it you liked about the cello?
I don't know. It was just a happenstance. I think it was just kind of good luck that I came across it, and I don't remember loving the repertoire of the cello or anything. It just became something that was part of my life, and I guess I got a lot of feedback from people around me that I was kind of, I had natural ability, and I think I coasted on that natural ability until I was 18 or something, and just rode my natural talent to that point, and then realized that it wasn't going to take me much further unless I put some work into it and made it happen. So I broke down my technique and built it up again, and spent my 20s kind of becoming a better musician.
So, just so I've got this clear in my head, Eric, a lot of cellists who've been playing for that length of time would, if they were able or naturally, go to a music college and learn the cello repertoire and study it and become an orchestral player or possibly a string quartet or whatever it is. But it would be down that classical route.
Right. I did take that route. I just took it late.
Right.
About age 19 or 20, I uh, I started going to music festivals, and they audition you at these music festivals, and I was always placed with people much younger than me. My level was not, my auditioning wasn't very strong, and so I was very embarrassed, and I knew I could do better, and so I just broke down my technique and built it up again, like obsessional practicing 5-6 hours a day, and I wanted to become a relevant musician in New York, you know, which meant making money, doing sessions, playing in orchestras, and I did all that.
Because I'd say there are a lot of cellists in New York.
Yes, a lot of very good cellists.
Yeah. And did you have a sense of how you could become that working musician? I mean, did you think you would be in an orchestra, working in Broadway in the pits, or
I did all that. Yeah, I thought about all of that, and it was my goal, and then my goal changed. It was kind of like, careful what you wish for, you may get it. I became that busy freelancing, Broadway playing, studio session, orchestra, and it wasn't working for me. I needed a more creative outlet for my
playing. How tough is that? I've seen those guys walking around New York, you know, with instruments over their shoulders and heading off to places, and that freelance musician. Obviously, there's more work there than there is, you know, anywhere else you probably think of, but it must be tough.
Well, it's tough. You find yourself on a roller coaster. You never say no. You're anxiously waiting phone calls. You're juggling a schedule of orchestral rehearsals and studio sessions. Back then, we had a lot of studio sessions. That has since dried up quite a bit in New York. I mean, it used to be I could do studio sessions and have that would be part of my yearly nut. And but that's since gone. But you know, you get into this frenetic, never say no. Yeah, I'll do it. You know, get me on the gig, and you just become locked into this kind of frenetic world.
And then you probably accept a certain gig, which means you're excluded from a whole lot of other gigs, and then that one falls flat, and then something else. You know,
right.
I'm not looking for numbers here, but can you make a good living doing that?
Yeah, it was union work, and that was kind of good. I mean, the good thing about Broadway and session work was you were treated like a professional, and there was no rehearsal, which was great. So at a studio session, you're expected to show up and be able to read whatever the composer puts down for the commercial or record date or whatever it is, and Broadway, I mostly subbed on Broadway, which meant I would come in and look at the book for a couple of shows and watch the show with the working cellist who was doing the show, and then I would come in and just read the whole thing, and it was I loved the challenge, and I would do really great on the first day. Everybody would say, "Oh, you did great, fantastic. We want to keep you as a sub," you know. And I progressively get worse and worse and worse as I learn the book and just become so bored.
Yeah.
And there's nothing more disheartening than turning a page on one of these big Broadway show books and seeing a note on the top of the page saying 2.5 hours left. You know? it's just very disappointing.
I often think that when I see musicians, particularly musicians who play cellos and violins and one thing or another, in orchestras playing stuff which isn't, you know, particularly interesting, because you know none of them started out wanting to do that.
None of them.
They all want to be
chamber players or soloists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not easy.
Orchestra musicians are some of the most unhappy lot because, like you said, they all... they're all very talented, and they probably could have a career if some one or two things went a bit better for their history. But and the other problem is it's so key to the orchestral experience is the conductor, and there's not that many great conductors.
We'll come back to this in a moment because musically we're still back in the soul days.
Yeah,
we got Sam and Dave.
Sam and Dave, one of my favorite groups, and just so. So amazing showman and amazing duo.
There you go. That's a song called Greenbacks from Ray Charles. And before that, Sam and Dave, When Something Is Wrong With My Baby. The choices of Eric Friedlander, who's with me in studio tonight, picking all the music. Eric's New York musician. I don't know what we call it now. Is it avant-garde jazz or avant-jazz? Or what? I don't know.
Downtown.
Downtown. We'll talk about that in a moment too. So just before that, we were talking about, you know, you've gone to New York and you've studied there and so on, but you're a working musician and you're taking all the gigs you can get, but you get tired of it, or tired of aspects of it. What are the thought processes when you think, right, I'm in this big city surrounded by brilliant musicians and I'm going to go off and try and do something of my own here?
Yeah, that was it. I needed to have a creative outlet, and so I started playing in I worked like a step-by-step process. I started playing with other people. I kind of started hanging out at the Knitting Factory on Houston Street in New York, and just going to gigs and listening to what was out there, and then I started playing with some of these musicians, and, you know, I wasn't that terrific right away, but I was learning, and I was getting my name out there, and I started a couple of bands myself, with co-led bands, you know, so I could do a little writing, and I just made a choice to kind of shift a percentage of my energy and attention to this creative music outlet and to kind of start saying no. I put a piece of paper by my phone that said, "Say no." You know, it was very hard to do. Like, someone calls you for a session, and they're just, you just feel like, oh, I got to take it. And I was able to say, to do that.
You're making these decisions then about what you want to do, and you're hanging around the Knitting Factory and all these places. But the thing is, your instrument is the cello.
Right.
And no,
but it was all there for me, because cello is it's wide open. There's no associations. It's just.
Yeah, but the thing is, and I'd like to get into this. You would have known, you knew different, you knew better, and I'm sure there were lots of people around there who knew better, but most people would assume or don't associate cello with anything other than
classical
repertoire. You know?
Yeah, right. And I just am stubborn, and just, I didn't know if it would work, but I didn't care. I was gonna do it anyway.
Yeah.
And I was just gonna create bands and with drums and bass and cello and you know, just that was gonna be my lead voice, and to hell with everything else. You know?
Because the Knitting Factory in particular, it was wide open. I mean, anything could happen there.
Right.
Who were you seeing around that? Who was playing at that particular period?
Well, Tim Byrne, John Zorn, Dave Douglas.
Steve Bernstein.
Bernstein.
And then sort of bigger names would come in and out.
Mark Dresser.
Like Lou Reed and people like
Lou
that.
Lou Reed, Laurie Anderson, you know. Yeah, it was a very rich time, and a lot was possible. It seemed like everything was possible.
And was there a particular aesthetic about that united all of those sorts of people?
Well, I guess the downtown aesthetic is kind of just like using all the influences of music that cross currents that we can tap into, and creating improvised based music from it.
And apart from the Knitting Factory, that downtown scene, all these places they're not there anymore, but there was a club called Tonic, wasn't there?
Yes, afterward. Yeah.
That was a bit later.
That was a bit later, Tonic, and now the Stone. And it just became a place, a center, a hub, if you will, of where musicians would get gigs and kind of one-up each other and kick each other's butts, just with new concepts and new projects. And it's just, New York is a very vibrant scene, and it's a great place to be if you're a musician.
And there were enough people in a big city like that to support that kind of music, wasn't there?
Yeah, mostly.
But those clubs aren't there anymore. Have they been, is it the rent situation again that's driven?
Yeah, they're just driven out of Manhattan. Well, the Stone is still in Manhattan now, and that's a viable place. I just completed a week there, a residency, and but there are lots of little clubs in Brooklyn and on the Lower East Side, New Blue, Barbez. There's a bunch of places. I mean, I my personal take on playing in New York is I just try out new work, and I don't expect to make a living from playing in New York. Creative music. I make my money on creative music, touring Europe.
So what's all that? Records. What's all that about? You don't expect to make a living in your own hometown.
Well, doing creative music. Creative music. Yeah. I do film scores. Yeah. I do commercial work, and
And is it the case now that there isn't an audience for that kind of creative work, or just
no? There's a little bit of an audience. It's just that the economics of playing live in New York is difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you're going to pay your musicians $100-$150 each, and most of the places take a cut of the door. The Stone is the only exception where. But many of these places take 40-50% of the door.
Sure.
It's just not possible to.
And those sorts of clubs, were you interested in, or were you visiting the other type of jazz club that was in New York, like the Vanguard?
The Big Village Vanguard, yeah. Places, yeah. Yeah, sure. If someone was playing, yeah. I sometimes played those clubs with Joe Lovano when I was in his band. John Zorn recently has broken through on at the Village Vanguard, and so we did some sets there, and that was really great.
I mean, that must be bringing a whole different crowd.
Jazz standard, yeah, it's a whole different crowd.
Yeah,
and you can make money at those places.
Yeah. We'd play some John Zorn in a minute, but just while we were talking about cello, the only cellist I knew at one point who was playing anything outside of classical music, or I suppose playing an ELO. ELO was Oscar Pettiford.
Yes.
And you made a record called Oscalypso.
Oscalypso, yeah.
Now tell me a little bit about Oscar Pettiford, and if you don't mind, I'll play one. It's not on your list, but I'd like to play him.
Oh, absolutely.
From your record.
Sure.
This was a tribute to Oscar Pettiford. So tell me a little bit about him.
Pettiford was an extraordinary bass player who, the story goes that he was playing softball with the Woody Herman band and injured his arm and couldn't carry his bass. And just negotiating the bass was a little bit difficult. And so a friend gave him a cello, and he strung it up like a bass, and it was much more manageable, so he could kind of play a little bit as he rehabbed his arm. And he fell in love with it. I mean, he really, I don't say that lightly, he really fell in love with the cello. I mean, he named his son Cello. He named his twin daughters Cellina and Celeste. The cello line continues. You know, I recently checked Facebook, and there's Cello Pettiford III.
Really?
Still, they have a website, and so there is. But he used the cello as the center of a band and wrote music for it. And he's one of the first great musicians to play the cello in a. He's not the first guy to play jazz on the cello, but he's the first really great musician to do it. And my heroes.
Play a track from Oscalypso, which was your tribute to Oscar Pettiford. What, Two Little Pearls, something like that?
That's a sweet one. That's where his two daughters, yeah.
Do you want that one, or Cello Again, or what?
Cello Again, yeah, that's more upbeat.
Oh, Cello Again, okay. Here we go, Oscar Pettiford. Cello Again, Eric Friedlander there, in a tribute to Oscar Pettiford, who's in my mind the only other cellist who plays jazz. But there are others, and we just, while that was on, I was saying to you that I had seen photographs, old photographs of African American musicians back, and in the middle of these, various brass instruments, what you would see a cello.
Yeah, evidently tenor players would double on the cello, and so they could be very flexible at a wedding, for instance. They could play the service and then play the dance later, and they would double on cello and tenor.
And is there any particular...
It doesn't happen anymore like that.
Yeah, but is there any particular reason why a cello is not common in a jazz situation? Because it's, you know, that satisfied me more than maybe perhaps jazz guitar would, actually, right, listening to that cello, you know?
It's a great sound, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a great sound. I'm not sure what the reason... One of the reasons is it's just a hard instrument. I mean, it's really hard, and But you know, these days there are so many more cello players playing at a high level than when I started. There was just a few, and a few in history, and a few playing at the time. And now there's just dozens. But there's, I always tell all the young players, it's still wide open for you. I mean, it's just there's so many. It's like the cello isn't, you mentioned it's associated with classical music, but it's a free agent when it comes to anything else. It's like you see it in rock bands, and it's just a great instrument for that.
And now with advances in technology, you can do so much more in terms of, you know, pedals and effects. And, you know, and it works really well in that context.
Yes, it does.
There's a musician called Julia Kent, you probably know her.
Yes.
Yeah, she does a lot of...
Yeah,
makes
absolutely.
A lot of interesting noises and sounds with the cello.
Yeah.
Now, your next choice is Duke Ellington. I'm just thinking if he ever he had violins and so on in his orchestras and all that. Did he have cellos at any point? I don't know that he had, but certainly not as a soloist. That's for sure.
No, he's this track is amazing. It was something I came across when I was. My father had a reel-to-reel tape deck, and at one point he upgraded to cassettes, and passed on the reel-to-reels to me. And he had a recording of "Take the A Train" by Duke Ellington, and it's an amazing arrangement with just.
No, you wanted this one in particular because there are several.
There's tons of arrangements, and this one is just, it's epic. It's a journey.
And this comes from Ellington Uptown.
Uptown, yeah.
Wow, that version of Take the A Train, that's a cracking version of it, isn't it?
Yeah,
it really
incredible.
Is. That's from Ellington Uptown. We're just saying how amazingly good the sound is. You can hear every instrument.
It's so perfect. Wow.
And the other thing, the other point is that someone like Ellington could have gone out every night and played the same arrangement and everybody would have been perfectly happy.
Yeah, evidently he kept reworking stuff. It's just, this one is particularly intricate. It has all these different sections and flows together beautifully. It's really, these are, a lot of these pieces are that we're playing tonight are things that I just got caught with, I got seduced by and would listen to over and over and over again. I would just constantly go through that last section with the hits and the horns and then that big solo at the end and the crashing finale. It was just something else.
Would you play this music to your friends and say, "Where do you hear this bit?"
Yeah, I was one of those annoying people. You got to hear this thing.
We're going to take a quick break, Eric. We'll be right back.
Okay.
This is Mystery Train on RTE Lyric FM. This is the Sunday night special where we get someone in to pick the tracks. And tonight my guest is Eric Friedlander, who I haven't seen for a while, and I'm delighted he's here. We're having a great time playing some great tunes. Eric is in Dublin for a few gigs with the Note people, Note Productions people. It's the Eric Friedlander duo series, and Eric will be performing with Sean Carpio and Cian Nugent, with Sean McAuliffe and Quaven O'Reilly at the Fumbly Stables on Wednesday the 31st. Then Thursday with Nadine Currie and Silver Kites, with Silver Kites, Thursday the 1st at 7 p.m. at Fumbly Stables, and on Friday Teatro Sin Fin with Sin Fin without end, I guess that means, with Mary Barnicott and Kevin Murray, Friday the 2nd also at Fumbly Stables. We'll mention those gigs again a little bit later on. Eric, we're about to move into the classical realm now after all the soul and the jazz that we've just had. Mozart. I've fallen out with people over Mozart because I, apart from some of the big pieces, I can't get overly excited about him. But you tell me it's transcendental.
Yeah, it's something just so like a diamond or something. It's just so utterly beautiful. And this piece we're going to listen to is another one of those pieces I obsessed on. And just the way the voice and the violins kind of crash into each other in this beautiful way. And there's a we call it interval a second. They go at this interval, and it sounds like sunlight to me or something. It's just it's so beautiful.
It sounds like sunlight.
Yeah,
lovely. That's a nice way to put it.
Yeah.
And this is one of the pieces that I do like, because it is a big piece. It's from the Mass in C minor.
Right.
The Laudamus, music from Mozart. Eric Friedlander is with me in studio tonight. Eric's picking all the music, and that's his first classical choice, music from Mozart, from the Mass in C minor. That's the Concentus Musicus Vienne, conducted by Nicholas Arnoncourt, with Christina Lackey singing, where Eric reckons it's Arnoncourt.
Yeah.
If it's Arnoncourt, you're in big trouble now, pal. So there we are. No, it's nice to hear that. And so were you always listening to classical music, Eric, or was this something you...
Yeah, I grew up listening to all different kinds of music in the house, and my father also he was one of the first guys I knew who got a cassette stereo in the truck. So we'd be going down the highway at 65 miles an hour and blasting Aretha and Bach cantatas and all different kinds of music, and it was... I just experienced music all the time. My father was very enthusiastic about music.
When did you reckon you got it? You were starting to get a bit of purchase with doing your own thing in that downtown scene.
I think when I started playing with Dave Douglas, and he put together a band which was kind of loosely called the String Band, and with Mark Feldman on violin and me and Mark Dresser playing bass, and Mike Serene on drums, and that band got kind of some attention, and in the world, that the downtown knitting factory world, we were kind of getting attention and just getting noticed. And then I started playing with Marty Ehrlich, and I started playing with other people. And then finally I got work with John Zorn, and that's that really put me on the map.
Now tell me about John Zorn. I saw John Zorn play once with Lou Reed and Laurie Anderson.
Oh, and Laurie?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I have to tell you, I like my music loud, and I like my music difficult.
Not that loud.
I actually felt like someone was sawing off the top of my head. It was that, it really was. It was an actual physical pain. It was, please stop. And of course, Lou was loving this. He just wanted to just make as much guitar noise as possible. But Zorn was playing very, very loud and very high.
Yes.
But he didn't always play like that, did he?
Well, it depends on what the music needs. It depends on, he's very, your description makes it sound to the contrary, but he's very careful about, you know, supplying what the music needs, and that, and probably in that case he feels that it's about some really unbridled expression.
Sure.
And but he's I've heard him sound like the most sweet jazz sax player in the world. He can do so many things.
As of course could Lou and Laurie, actually. They could be quite tender if they wanted to be.
Just
as well.
Those improv situations are about energy and, I guess, volume in this case.
Yeah. I've just mentioned in John Zorn. I'm going to put in a track here that I'm going to choose. Well, you can pick which one, but you mentioned Mark Feldman a moment ago, the violinist. This is a record with yourself and Mark Feldman and Greg Cohen on bass.
Right, the Masada String Trio is one of the groups that formed after we did a record called Bar Kokhba, which was a larger group that we went on the road with and toured Europe. And at these gigs, we would learn the music for the set the same day as the concert. It was kind of a crazy experience because John had the the booking agent, list the local 5-4-star Michelin restaurant or 3-star Michelin restaurant in the book. So we would have reservations at this restaurant, and we would rehearse from 1 to 5 or 1 to 6 and then go eat at this 4-3-star Michelin restaurant and then come and back and play the concert and learn new music every day on a 12-day tour. It was the most exhausting experience. And it was something else to come from this very rich meal every night. And we would finish the meal at like 7:30 and go to do a downbeat at 8. And it was just, it was crazy. But one of the groups that formed on this tour was the Masada String Trio. And it became kind of an iconic group. And it was special in a couple of ways because it's just a great natural sounding group of instruments. And the other thing was that John would conduct sitting on the floor in front of us. So it was kind of, you had to be on your toes all the time because he would cue you for a solo or cue you to improvise and switch and solos and accompaniments. And he was like a Normandy or a classical conductor down on the floor. And
this is from Book of Angels, Volume 16.
Wow.
So it's quite a project.
Yeah.
What do we play from this? What do you reckon? Are you any particular faves from this one? This is the string quartet, a string trio.
I'd have to see this.
Plays Masada Book 2.
Masada Book 2. That's another 300 pieces that he wrote. These are tunes we don't even play anymore.
We play the first one, eh?
Yeah.
Let's see what happens. Let's just play the first one.
That's a good call.
Music there from John Zorn, which features Eric there on cello, Mark Feldman on violin, Greg Cohen on bass. And it sounds like there's more than three people there in that trio.
Yeah, it's a great sounding group. It's great to hear this music because we haven't played in a while. We did a concert in San Francisco like a month ago, but we don't play this Book 2 music so much anymore.
And it works like just like a jazz band. That's
right.
How it works.
Yeah, it's just a head like a tune, and then we play over the changes. And it's just that in this case, unlike a normal jazz band that doesn't have a conductor, we have a conductor. So you heard a lot of different changes that we move through, and you know, where we would answer each other with short solos, playing four bars each, and then that's John pointing at one of us from one to the other, and then a bass solo, then exchanging fours, and then take it down an octave. All these are hand signals, so it's kind of maddening and exciting at the same time to play because it's you have to be on your toes. And he's known to make a gesture when you miss one of his calls. He puts his finger by his eye and goes like this and looks at you and like, watch
it.
Me.
That's it.
MF-er.
Okay. Now, your next choice is McCoy Tyner.
Yeah.
Who, you know, great musician in his own right, but also, of course, well-known for being the piano player in Coltrane's classic.
Right, and just a signature sound and energy, just like massive energy and modal kind of, it's almost like he's a rhythm, it is a rhythm instrument, piano, but just a rhythm machine.
Now we have you here. The word modal keeps coming up when people talk about jazz.
Right.
Modal. Have you got a succinct explanation of what modal is? I have a vague notion in my head of what it is, but I couldn't explain it.
Well, when you hear, like, take the A train, the chords are very they're not modal. They're very clearly functioning as a major chord, a minor chord, or a dominant chord. Modal chords are more ambiguous. They have the feeling of... it's like the feeling of Debussy or Ravel, the kind of modal harmony, which is the function of the chord is more ambiguous and hazy and kind of melting.
Yeah. And these chords that you always hear McCoy Tyner in particular playing behind.
He constantly, we call it upper structures. There's like lots of notes on the upper side of the, that are not the root, third, fifth, and seventh. It's the ninth, 11th, 13th, and... beyond.
There you have it, folks.
Yeah.
You've come to the right place tonight. And that's McCoy Tyner there from the Super Trios with Tony Williams is on drums there, Eric.
And Tony Williams and Ron Carter.
Ron Carter. That's a fine band.
One of the Super Trios. The other one is Eddie Gomez and Jack DeJohnette.
Wow.
It's an amazing record. I was thinking about how, you know, I was so into rock and roll for so many years when I was a high school student. And something about that song has kind of a rock and roll energy to me. And I could see why I was captivated by it.
Now, your next choice, we're moving into we have a couple of movie themes coming up here.
Right.
And
film soundtracks is a great source of inspiration for me. I mean, I'm a film composer myself. I've done a handful of films, and I'm looking forward to doing a lot more. Recently, I've gotten more busy doing it, and it's really fun work.
And you enjoy that, do you?
I really do, yeah. And I think because of my history growing up with my father and the photography and the music, so much of it, I feel like I have maybe a certain ability to conceive a picture with music, music with picture. And so I'm pretty comfortable with exploring the relationship between the two. And
but it's a collaborative thing, though, isn't it? Of course, most music can be collaborative, but it's a
very different thing. You have to adjust your expectations. When I'm working on my bands, you know, my new groups and writing music, I just have to make myself happy.
Yeah.
And I still do that when I write film scores, but it's I have to make the director happy.
Yeah.
And if he or she doesn't like what I do, there's no arguing.
Yeah.
But it's great. How can you not tell? How can you not see it works? You know, it's not about me. And I just have to, like, I sometimes get so enamored with a track that I write, and I just can't believe that it's not being accepted. But it's not, and it's just you just have to reconcile with that.
There's a great documentary about Philip Glass, where he's working with Woody Allen on a movie, and he brings in a piece of music, you know, and it doesn't work. And Philip Glass, he seems to be a very humble man, just going, okay, and he just came back the next day with another piece of music.
Oh, that's good.
You know.
Sometimes it doesn't work that way. You get you don't even know you don't know anything about music. Who do you think you are?
Well,
I once worked with Morricone and in a session with De Palma, and De Palma came out and asked Morricone to do something for a scene. Could he have the music crescendo and then decrescendo and then crescendo again? And Morricone looked at him and said, "Never in the history of music has this happened, and I don't think it would work well here." And De Palma was just kind of stunned, and they eventually worked it out, and Morricone was helpful, but he initially met that request with a firm rebuttal.
I suppose you get to a point where you're considered the master.
Right.
And then the roles get reversed.
You know, never before in the history of music has this happened.
The movie starts to serve the music or something in some strange way. Anyway, your first, we run a couple of these together. People might people might recognize them, actually. The first one's from Chinatown. Jerry Goldsmith did some amazing stuff, though.
Oh, he's amazing.
Did he do Planet of the Apes, did he?
I don't know.
I think he did. A particularly weird soundtrack.
Yeah, he's one of the greats, and he's two of my favorite soundtracks are Chinatown and Alien.
Yeah.
And for Chinatown, he came on the job just 2 weeks before the film was released and had to do a rush job, and he came up with this pianos, harps, and trumpets and strings kind of soundtrack with a lot of... He always comes up with a special sound, like inside the piano sounds. And for Alien, he had all sorts of strange piping that was blown through and creating kind of alien moving sounds, and it's just a spectacular job.
Well, we play the love theme from Chinatown, followed with a piece of music from Alien. No messing there, Eric. Music from Jerry Goldsmith from the movie Alien.
So amazing.
And then before that, music from Chinatown. Two very different pieces,
yes.
Obviously, yeah.
Very different atmospheres.
You can tell he knows his jazz, but you can also tell he's listened to Stravinsky and all the
right.
rest of it. You know?
He's got all the skills.
Chops.
Yeah.
They're all there. Extraordinary. And would when in your own writing for the movies, you know, would that idea of working with a big orchestra like that really appeal to you? Would that?
It would. I haven't done a score like that yet. Right now, my scores tend to be kind of more intimate, small groups with, you know, guitars, cello, harp, prepared piano. It depends on the film, but it tended to be more intimate. So
next Star Wars, I think.
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. Call me.
Now, your next musical choice, it's prog rock.
Yeah, it is.
There's no question about it.
I'm raising my prog rock flag.
Well, no, the reason I say that is it's come up a few times in recent Sundays about the idea of prog rock and how, you know, there was a period when it was absolutely the worst thing imaginable.
Right.
You know, you weren't allowed right. to acknowledge its
exactly.
existence.
I think that's still a little bit true.
And it's still there, but it's harder and harder to take that approach when so much of the music that is now considered extremely cool is actually prog rock.
Right.
When you look at it.
Right.
When you listen to it, what they're actually doing is just the same thing.
Right.
However, there is a kind of a thing hangs over Yes, in particular, because of the costumes and dressing up
costumes
with wizards.
And the words yeah. are so preposterous
yeah.
and seemingly meaningful only to John Anderson.
We're going to play a track from Close to the Edge.
Right.
I think if anybody ever had a Yes album, this is probably the one they had.
Right, or Fragile.
Fragile.
Yeah.
And Close to the Edge, you know, I can remember the cover.
Green.
There was a guy called Roger Dean did the posters.
Right.
I had, at a certain age, there was a Roger Dean poster of a cat jumping across.
Oh, right.
There was a kind of a Buddha kind of a figure or something, or I don't know, a jester, magicians, wizards.
Right.
And there was a cat leaping through the air. Roger Dean. It's all coming back to me now.
Yeah.
But
good memories?
Well, even then I thought Yes were a bit daft, you know.
Right.
But why should we listen to, in your humble opinion, Eric, why should we listen to Siberian Catru?
Siberian Catru is one of the things that I was into was guitar players, you know, Steve Howe, Jimi Hendrix, Rick Derringer, Johnny Winter, just all these rock and roll guitar players. I was in Santana. I was into that. And there's something about the rock and roll expression on guitar, which is so, it's like hand in glove. It goes so well together, guitar and rock and roll. It's just amazing. And I bring some of that energy to my playing, I think, or I try. So I was very into Steve Howe. I loved all these guitar-based bands and Rick Wakeman was great. But just the intricacies of the tunes, and I also played Rickenbacker bass in a band, and so Squire was.
I bet
was
you were into Rush, fan. Were you? Did
Rush?
You like
no,
Rush?
No, I wasn't into Rush.
No, because they had a Rickenbacker bass too, and it was also kind of long-winded, preposterous music. Okay, sorry. Back to Steve Howe again.
Yeah, but I just found that like these kind of epic journeys were kind of great, and also the musician in me really appreciated the really difficult things that they were doing.
Although, as my father used to say, it's a pity it wasn't impossible. Anyway, here comes Siberian Catru from Yes. And that's Yes, the choice of Eric Friedlander, who's with me in studio. We've time for two more tracks, and we're going to go straight into this one because we haven't a whole lot of time left. We'll not be able to play all of it because it is 8 minutes and 31 seconds long.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the start. I mean, even though Jimmy Page is a great lead player, it's the riff is this song.
Oh, the
it?
Riffs are amazing.
This is the riff. And that's Kashmir from Led Zeppelin, from Physical Graffiti. Photographing the cover is probably your house, Eric, is it? That's probably where you live. it's down your part of the world as far as that's Lower East Side somewhere, isn't it?
Lower East Side, yeah.
So there we go. Eric Friedlander, my guest tonight, picking all the music. Eric, it's great that we could get this time with you because
you just come in from
the Big Apple and all that. And I really enjoyed the music that you picked, Eric. Thanks a lot for coming in. And
pleasure, and John. Just, great to see you as usual.
It's been great. And we'll see you again soon, I hope. I'll mention these gigs again, actually, before we go.
Thank you, yeah.
Wednesday night, you are playing with Sean Carpio, Cian Nugent, Sean McElhane, and Quevin O'Reilly. That'll be an astonishing lineup. You've played with all those guys before, have you? Or most of them? Oh, you haven't?
First time.
Oh, that'll be something.
Yeah.
That's at the Fumbly Stables Wednesday night. And doors at 7 p.m. sharp. Then on Thursday night with Nadine Khoury with Silver Kites, Thursday the 1st, also at Fumbly Stables. And then on Friday with the Teatro Sin Fin with Mary Barnicott and Kevin Murphy. Fumbly Stables, soon to be a stadium, Friday the 2nd. That should be something, that, Eric. You're working with some very, very fine musicians there.
Yeah, I got my work cut out for me.
Well, you'll be up to it. And we're going to finish with another McCoy Tyner track. So why have you come back to McCoy for this one?
Just the performance, the drama of this performance. He does a kind of an amazing thing at the end of the tune where big crescendo and then it drops down to these two dramatic soft notes. And it's always struck me how beautiful, it's a beautiful tune, you know, it's a Coltrane tune, it's really gorgeous.
So this is Naima from McCoy Tyner, from the Echoes of a Friend album, because he's recorded this a couple of times as well, I think.
Yeah. Oh,
Echoes
yeah.
of a Friend. Eric, thanks a million for coming in.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to a podcast of Mystery Train with John Kelly. Mystery Train hits the rails every Sunday to Thursday at 7 p.m. on 96 to 99 RTE Lyric FM.